My guest today has been guiding people towards a deeper understanding of what choices they can make, and she's doing it from the largest democracy in the world. She's in New Delhi, India. She is well known to people in this audience, Vandana Shiva. She's internationally renowned environmental and social activist and was formerly one of India's top nuclear physicists. She has been credited as the principal founding leader of India's ecological and ecofeminism movement. In 1982, Dr. Shiva founded the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Ecology in New Delhi, which led to the creation of an organization dedicated to the restoration of organic farming across India and the preservation of indigenous knowledge and culture. She is also one of the leaders of the board of the International Forum on Globalization with Ralph Nader and Maud Barlow and Gerrymander. And for several decades, she has fought for changes in the globalization practices of agriculture and food. She has received numerous international acknowledgments, including the Alternative Nobel Peace Prize, the Right Livelihood Award, and UEP's Global 500 Award and the UN's Earth Day Award. And she's written many books, including Earth Democracy and Soil Not Oil. Nice to have you with us today.
Hello. Hello, Gary.
When I look at the largest democracy, in some respects I see your institutions being very similar to how they impact the lives of their citizens as do ours. We have bloated bureaucracies. We have politicians who spend an inordinate amount of their time just politicking instead of leading. We have people who will listen to those in positions of wealth and power rather than the average citizen. And at the bottom of this, we have environmental degradation that people give a wink and a nod to after declaring and decrying that it wasn't a problem for decades. Now that it is a problem, they're sure someone's going to get on it, but they need more studies. And these studies will probably take between 5,000 and 6,000 years in their time. So we know that the moment anyone says we need to study it, we know that it will never be addressed in that person's lifetime. That's the reality in America. I cannot speak for India. But you can. So now when you look and you look at your society and you look at our society, I would like for you to address the people in this audience who are saying, I wasn't told to eat organic growing up. I wasn't told about sustainable farming. We never thought about where something on our plate came from. We just ate it. And today we're eating the worst food imaginable, causing diabetes and obesity and diseases that we should not have. But our doctors are not telling us not to eat this. The people who run the television network, 60 Minutes, is not telling us not to eat this. The people on our talk shows, Sean Hannity, Bill O'Reilly, and the left, certainly, are not telling us not to eat this. So we go ahead and eat the junk foods. We eat pesticides. We drink polluted water. We're told that our water is great coming out of the tap because they would never allow us to drink polluted water and wouldn't allow us to take vaccines if they weren't safe and effective. And so now we don't know what to do. We're just in a big mess. And so Americans are finally, many, not all, at are such a crisis in their lives that they're looking for some help. They're looking for some direction. They're looking to be made whole again. Tell us about first your country, the problems you face, what you've done to help redirect these people back to a sense of true spiritual living, and what we can learn from your lesson to help us in our crisis here in our country.
Well, the first issue really is that with globalization, the world is being mirrored in the pattern of the corporate domination that the U.S. has been subjected to for nearly a century. So if you look at Indian agriculture in the last two decades of liberalization, as it's called, but I would rather call it corporatization, we see our seed diversity disappear. We see farmers get deep into debt, just as much as family farmers in the U.S. got into debt. The difference between U.S. and Indian farmers is that when a farm is foreclosed in the U.S., there's usually some other place to go to. In India, it's happened so suddenly, and the farmers who were pushed into adopting genetically modified seeds, for example, the BT cotton seeds, with the promise that they would be millionaires, when they find themselves trapped in debt, they end up taking their lives, drinking pesticide. And now the count is 200,000 since 1997. This is because of the same agriculture that drove small farmers off the land in the United States. 1989, we had a tremendously strong law to regulate genetically engineered organisms, including foods. 89 was before the commercialization of genetic modification in the area of food and agriculture. The commercialization started in the 90s. It's also in the mid-90s that giant corporations like Monsanto use the World Trade Organization to coercively open markets for their seeds and their foods on a worldwide level. They came into India in 97-98. We have since then seen a series of attempts at deregulating our laws. And now we have a treaty between U.S. and India, on the board of which sit Monsanto, Walmart, ConAgra, ADM, to decide what India's agriculture should be. Not the people of India, not a partnership between the people of India and the people of the United States, but U.S. agribusiness, which has destroyed, as you mentioned, Gary, the food system of the United States, cursing the Americans with the worst food this planet has, and now bringing that junk food and poison food to our platter. So how do we deal with it? I began in a very small way when I realized what was in store for us as human beings across the planet. I began small by saving seeds, because that's something we could do, and also because the seed embodies the rest of the food chain. So if you've saved the seed, you've saved the freedom for the rest of your food system. The second thing we started to do was just spread ourselves out and help farmers get out of the addiction to chemicals and out of the addiction to the promise, false promise of prosperity through new non-renewable seeds. And today there are more than 500,000 farmers who've been linked with us, who've been trained by us, who are our members. We also help the farmers find an alternative market in a world dominated by a Walmart as the only marketing option. We have to do what we shouldn't have to do in a normal society. We have to bring farmers in direct connection to those who eat the food. Those three aspects of saving seeds, promoting a chemical-free, GMO-free agriculture called organic worldwide, and creating direct chains, more intimate links between producers and eaters, is something we've done. And the fact is, for 20 years, we've kept afloat. And I think that's a miracle in a world of economic crashes. We've kept afloat because of solidarity. We've kept afloat because of our commitment to do the right thing for the earth and to do the right thing as producers.
I appreciate your overview. Thank you. I want to go a little further with this and bring it down to the intimacy of the average farmer. But let me give you a little preface to this and an overview and see if you could tie this in to your answers, all right? I'm a certified organic farmer. I have been a farmer, and I've had the first food co-op in New York State. I helped start the High Falls Food Co-op, and my farm, the Fertiller Farm, was raising and foods organically and then selling them locally. And I noticed something, that one of my neighbors was growing nuts in an orchard, another one had apples, someone else had pears, and I simply went one to another. I says, you know, we could all share with one another. If I'm growing vegetables, root vegetables, why don't we, you know, I'll give you a case of any vegetable you want, and you give me a case of apples. I couldn't believe that no one had actually thought of something this simple. Down in Texas, the same way. I had a big ranch north of Dallas, an hour north of Dallas, and I had a five-acre garden. So I produced far more than what I could eat, and I would take it to the local churches and give it to them. But I went to my neighbors, and I'll never forget this. I walked up to this woman's house, and I knocked on her door, and she came to the door. And I said, I thought you would like to have some vegetables here. And I laid out about three cases, and I said, please take anything that you want. She said, oh, well, I can't eat all that. I said, well, root vegetables don't go bad, so you just store them in your fridge for a long time. I said, and take what you need. And she's okay. And then I said, do you know any homebound people? She said, oh, there are a lot of homebound people here. There's a lot of older people. There's only 240 people in the town. So I made a list of all the homebound people, and then I started delivering them. And again, I did this, I gave it to them for free. Vegetables, at least what we were growing, and if they had, I had chickens that ate insects. I'm a vegan, but the chickens were great. They would eat the fire ants and drop manure and scrape up the grounds, so they served multiple purposes, and the eggs I gave to these people. And about 3 days later, I opened up my door, and there were about 30 bags or bushels of food, of all kinds. People who had grown stuff were sharing it back with me. And I thought, how nice. Well, within 6 months, it was just normal for people to share this way. Now, I give you that as a backdrop because I haven't seen that in a long time. I don't see it in urban America. I do see it occasionally in rural America, but more often than not, people grow corn, that's it. They go to the store, they buy their bread, they buy their produce at a supermarket. And unfortunately, the supermarket most people are buying at, including organic, is either Walmart, which I'm opposed to. Now, I'm not opposed to organic them selling organic produce, but if Walmart sells organic produce, every local market, health food store, a farmer's market that sells organic produce will be challenged because people are going to say, well, I can buy the same organic cheaper there. And Whole Foods is the Walmart of health food stores. There's a lot of garbage in that store. It has wrong ideals. For every Whole Foods that opens up, all the small health food stores go out of business. And no one looks at it that way, especially the kind of guilt-ridden people who shop there thinking, well, I'm buying trendy food. No, the largest department's alcohol. The second largest department is meat and processed foods, junk foods, toxic foods. If you took all the unhealthy foods out of a Walmart, all the unhealthy foods out of a Whole Foods, you're left with a little 3,000 square foot health food store. Why not shop at a local farmer's market or health food store like that to begin with? So we've lost even our sense of consciousness about food. It's like Al Gore going to the premiere of An Inconvenient Truth in a private jet. There's something grossly inappropriate with Leonardo DiCaprio, who actually did a pretty good film, and I recommended his film, The 11th Hour, about global warming, but he goes around in a private jet. Bono talks about the environment and flies in a private jet. They never seem to care about their own contradictions. So we are a country, if nothing else, of contradictions. Rather interesting, Michael Moore's got a new capitalism, you know, he's against capitalism. Well, hello, Michael. You made $25 million on Sitka when I know where you live. And, you know, stop with a hat and, like, somehow you're one of us. You know, you're... No. And it's okay. He deserves what he makes. But let's stop being a nation of contradictions and hypocrisy because it's palpable. And it's time that we were what we are. And if you're really caring about organic, support local small farmers market food co-ops, health food stores, and be conscious in your choices. Now, that's my little song and dance, but I wanted to lead that in because I know at one time India had the very same concept of people sharing collectively and cooperatively together, and I believe that a lot of that, much of it got lost. Could you tell us that story in depth, please?
Well, even today, the parts of India where you do not see hunger, where you do not see starvation, where you do not see severe malnutrition, is in the areas where there was no loss of the economy of sharing that you have described, the economy of abundance, because sharing creates abundance. The pockets where the deepest malnutrition are there, and India, interestingly, in the period of high growth, has emerged as the capital of hunger in the world, showing very clearly that high growth does not translate into removing hunger and poverty, and actually only concentrates wealth and power in a few hands, disenfranchising the majority, leaving them without their basic needs and basic food. Why is there hunger in the world? Why are 1 billion people permanently hungry? Because either they've been pushed off the land so that someone can make money, putting up a factory, putting up a biofuel plantation, putting up a mine, or they have been pushed into an industrial agriculture where they are constantly on a treadmill, buying costly inputs and getting into debt and not being able to eat their own produce, being forced to sell everything they grow. And increasingly, farmers around the world are growing fewer and fewer non-edible crops. They're growing more cotton, they're growing more soybean, which is going more for cattle feed, it's going more for biofuel. Corn, most of the GM corn, similarly, cattle feed, biofuel. We are not growing food anymore, and that's why there's scarcity in the world. There's seed scarcity because Monsanto has designed seeds to create scarcity. The terminator logic, the very idea that seeds should terminate, become sterile, is a logic of scarcity. And what you describe about you sharing three boxes and getting sacks full in return is the way societies have always provided for themselves. Then you've got the period of the Green Revolution, globalization, genetic modification. But what we are doing, just as what you did, is creating these intimate distribution systems. With the huge levels of hunger in India right now, and the fact that the farmers, like American farmers, earn nothing, but when you go to buy food, you're paying 100 times more than what the farmer got, this is a recipe for those who grow the food going hungry, and it's a recipe for those who are too poor to buy costly food going hungry. To break this, that's what you have described, the direct exchange. I grow turnips, you grow tomatoes, we can exchange and create more food, more well-being, more taste, more quality for each other. We have started to create local community-led food distribution systems where there's food swap. So some areas grow sugarcane and grow the natural organic sugar. Other areas can't. Up in our mountains don't grow sugarcane. So we do a swap between the beans the mountains grow and the sugar, the gur, the natural sugar that the plains grow. That is the exchange we need, beginning with the most intimate level. And that is a recipe for both abundance but as well as freedom, because I really believe that is where freedom will come from.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Could you give us an idea of what life is like for the different types of classes of people in India? Much as we have a class system, you have a very old class system, dwarfing ours. We're a young country compared to India. You have over 900 religions. You have more dialects than any other country in the world, including Africa. So you have enormous diversity. And yet, through this democracy, there's something that puzzles me. Many, many Indians that previously were healthy are now being listed in the international journals as having diabetes, obesity, heart disease, high blood pressure, elevated cholesterol, and cancers that were not at the same level pre this great economic boom that India has been swept up in, 6, 8, 12% growth, which is phenomenal. It's up there near China. So you have about 255 million Indians living in the upper middle class status. What has changed in their life? And also, here in the United States, this is the second part of my question, most people who gain wealth or power choose to exclude other people who are not like them and to move into conclaves. They'll move into special gated areas. They go to a country club. They like to have a home where others, the average person, could not have. And then we have this kind of ooh and awe towards those who have so much, the rich and famous. And the rich and famous tend to socialize together. They vacation together. They work together. They do deals together. Every year out in August, there's this man who puts on this one-week conference where industrial leaders all get together and decide what they're going to do. Now, what they decide to do will impact everyone else, because what they're going to do is create something we're supposed to consume. But none of us are invited to have any input. There's no activists. There's no dissidents. There's no progressive minds. There's not a single progressive mind invited. Nobody wants reform. In fact, if anything, they want deregulation. They want uninhindered free market access to anyone so they can figure out ways to explain it. You have Warren Buffett. You have Bill Gates. You have Bill Clinton. You have the top heads of every industry who go there. Now, you can get far enough away from the poor and the middle class in America that you don't even know they exist. But in India, how do the rich live? How do the upper middle class live? How do the middle class live? How do the poor classes live? Because you can show us what we don't know. Do they live in the same environment but separated by walls or a gate or something where you can still see the other people? Show us that inner dynamic. I think that would be a very interesting look into the sociology of India, as well as the first question about the health of Indians being adversely affected by following our diet like the Chinese have, and the environmental impact of this. So tell us about the health, the sociology, the class system, and the environmental impact in any order you choose. The forum is yours.
Well, India has had hierarchies, ancient hierarchies, as you mentioned, the caste system being one of them. And in fact, the name Shiva was picked by my parents in order to resist caste by giving up their caste name. So Shiva is our family's caste liberation symbol. But what you see in the class division now is very, very different from what used to be even till 20 years ago. For one, the lifestyle of a rural person and the lifestyle of an urban person was not hugely different. They didn't belong to two different classes. But now they do. Rural India is being pushed deeper and deeper and deeper into poverty. And urban India, especially the top part of urban India, is living the levels of luxury lifestyles like America, and the super rich, of which the 10 richest Forbes, of the 10 richest people in the Forbes list, 4 are Indians. And this has happened in the last decade. Where did they get their wealth? Partly out of speculation, partly out of grabbing the resources of the poor. Now they sit not just in gated communities, they sit in palaces. Not one palace, many palaces. They have private jets. They never come in contact with reality. They think just because their ship is rising, all boats are rising. They imagine their billions is translating into the end of poverty for the rest of India. And unfortunately, contemporary governments, whether it's your government or the Indian government, contemporary governments have turned rich people into their advisors. In India, we used to have a system where the advisor of the king was always the person who had nothing. He was the sage, or she was the sage in the forest. And the reason their advice was best is because they had no material interest in accumulation. They had a total detachment in terms of what was good for society. And also because they were sages, they were spiritual, they meditated, they could see the larger whole. So every king had a rishi who advised them. Today, the advisors are the Gates and the Ambanis. What do they advise the governments about? How to help them get richer. And they have a brilliant way of turning every mechanism of their getting rich into somehow helping the poor. Bill Gates, interestingly, is the man pushing the worst of agriculture on the world scale. He runs AGRA, the Alliance for the Green Revolution in Africa, at a time where the Green Revolution has failed India, left a huge water famine. The recent NASA study has shown how depleted the groundwater of northern India, the land of the Green Revolution, has become, with more than 100 cubic kilometers disappearing in 5 years' time. But not only does Gates sit as the head financier of AGRA, he then pushes FAO, he pushes other governments to go that line. He also sits on the Global Alliance for Vaccine Improvement, which is what is pushing vaccines in every field, and he sits on another nasty global alliance called the Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition, which is trying to introduce processed packaged foods to babies and all children in the name of removing malnutrition. We have a very, very big issue. We are resisting this democratically in India, both the issue of the vaccines as well as the issue of processed food, junk food for children. Why are Indians getting unhealthy like the Americans? Because Indians are being made to eat unhealthy food like the Americans. Our food is not as glamorous, as well known as the Italian cuisine, which is now on the UNESCO heritage list of good eating. But diversity is what makes food healthy. And any day, Indian food is more diverse, both region to region, but in every meal, we would eat at least sources of 25 to 30 plants in every meal. And that helps nutrition. When your food habits are driven not by this time-tested culture of healthy eating and the knowledge of Ayurveda, one of the most ancient scientific systems of healthcare, healing, as well as food, and instead the choices of society are driven by ads targeted at young children, Choco of Kellogg's sells itself as replacing chapatis and makes it look like a good thing, that loaded sugar is made to look like better than the staple food of an ancient civilization. Maggi noodles, the Nestle product, is the ultimate advertisement on television. Of course, children will move towards all this. And what we have seen, because we work with school programs, we work on a good food campaign with school children, what we have seen is the jumping of obesity rates in school from 7% to 14% over the last decade up to 2005, and between 2005 and this year, it has jumped to 24%. Now, that's every fourth kid in a Delhi school being obese, and India, of course, is the epicenter of diabetes. The rich get diabetes because they're pushed into junk food, but the poor are also getting diabetes because their staples are being robbed from them. For example, a vegetarian diet in India gets protein from pulses, from leguminous nitrogen-fixing crops. Dal has been our staple. The Green Revolution drove pulses out to promote monocultures of rice and wheat. And the new breeding of rice and wheat led to decreased nutrition and a glycemic index that is contributing to higher diabetes, especially with people having nothing else to eat but just rice, nothing else to eat but just bread. And that problem for the poor is a result of one kind of malnutrition, but the problem of the rich is also a malnutrition, because I do not think obesity and diabetes is healthy living. How are people living in India? Gated communities. In fact, you know, we used to, till I live in Delhi. When I'm in Delhi, I live in a place called Horse Cast, which means the great tank. In Dehradun, I live on a Rajpur Road. Our farm is on in a village called Ramgarh. Now, these are all very local names. The new colonies that are coming up around Delhi are Orange County. You pick any place of California and you'll have a colony in its name, and the housing is modeled on that, the gating is modeled on that. I would imagine even the building contractors come from the United States.
Would you like to comment on your thoughts about mandatory vaccines, what you've seen or experienced in the vaccine movement in India, and what your thoughts on this whole issue are, please?
It's interesting, Gary. I have a sister who's a medical doctor who works on these issues. So I hear from her all the time. A, how our public sector vaccine units were shut down so that these untested, unnecessary vaccines can be imposed. And normally they're introduced through public health plans, so there's constant revaccination of the same kids with polio vaccines, and now you have emergence of polio because of vaccination. There are attempts to make more and more risky combinations. And I would suggest, Gary, you get her on your show one day. Dr. Meera Shiva is her name, and she knows it inside out. what I do with food, she does with health.
Great. I'll look forward to that. Let's go now to the positive solutions. We're seeing that what we've done in America, certainly in some levels, mirrors on many levels what has happened and is happening in India. But there's a whole lot of difference in population size. We're 306 million. You're 2.2 billion. You're only 400,000 away from India, from China. You have a lot of poor people. Let's look at what you're doing about your environment. Is the government being proactive about water? And if not, why not? And sewage and sanitation. How many people are drinking polluted water? How's that contributing to social diseases of all types, like tetanus and diphtheria and cholera? And also the exploitation of the land. Do you have an active, vibrant, back to the earth movement? And if so, how's it working? And what is the state of most people's consciences concerning the land, the environment, the water, the soil in India? Could you give us those overviews, please?
Well, you know, the environment and natural resources in India are people's real capital, and they are the main source of livelihood. I often jokingly say the earth is the biggest employer here, not the government, not corporations, just the land and its resources. Most people are farmers, fishermen, forest dwellers, and it's the earth that provides them the employment. As globalization has tried to grab the resources of the poor, I've written a chapter in my book, Soil Not Oil, titled Outsourcing of Pollution and Outsourcing of Resource Grab. What's happened is basically that on the one hand, the environment has got degraded. On the other hand, the poor people have lost what little they had. Both in China and India, it shows up worst in terms of what's happened to our water systems. They're either depleted or polluted. I've grown up in an India where you could stop at any stream, any river, and drink water. In my own lifetime, I've seen clean rivers become drains of industrial effluence. The Yamuna River in Delhi, 22 kilometers of it, carries 70% of the pollution load of the whole river. Our industrial areas, urban systems have become major sources of polluting the rivers. Meantime, climate change is also creating a huge water crisis. I'm involved in a major program of climate change in the Himalaya, where we've involved communities to monitor, because as you said in the beginning, all that the government says, we got to study more. So they want to study whether the glaciers are melting. The communities will tell you this glacier was 25 foot thick. It's now 1 foot thick. They'll tell you exactly how much it has receded. So that's the documentation we're doing. And in one decade, 70% of the streams, which were the main source of water in the mountain areas, have gone. 70%. So, of course, people will be condemned to drink bad water, and you will get more diseases. The environmental problem and the poverty problem in India is totally inseparable. And the reason for me, protecting biodiversity, protecting land, protecting water is an ecological issue, but it's also a justice issue. And that's why I've supported every movement of farmers in defense of their land, from corporate grab to set up the Tata Nano factory in West Bengal, to set up the steel factories in Orissa. And the wonderful thing is self-organized peasantry, with no one behind them, have held out in place after place. There is one thing most people in the West don't know, and that is that one-third of India is now not governable. And it's not governable because the radical left has taken over through violence. Unfortunately, the government has given them the name Maoists or Naxalites, as the 72 movement. And every one of these movements are in reality tribal movements in defense of land. That's what they are. But they are being defined as extremists, they're being defined as terrorists, and they're being treated as that. So what you see in Afghanistan through the US and other allied forces, we are seeing in parts of India through the government of India invading the tribal lands in order to clear up the forests, to clear up the mining areas for global capital. We see the war unleashed by global capital in the poorest homes and the poorest villages of this country.
Let's say hello.
Thank you, Gary.
Yeah, let's say hello to Peter from Maryland. Hi, Peter. You're on with Dr. Shiva.
Hello, Gary. Yes, Dr. Shiva, my question has to do with the rice that as a staple that the people of India are eating. I've been told that this rice is polished. Is this true? And how does this relate to the increased diabetes in India?
Well, you're very, very right. Polished rice has a very big role. We never ate polished rice. We used to eat hand-pounded rice, and hand-pounded rice maintains all the nutrients of the rice. Unfortunately, part of what globalization has done is destroy home processing and small-scale processing and made milling more and more centralized, the process that we saw in the United States. And polished rice is the killer.
Thank you.
White rice, white bread, white pasta, the white foods are extremely
dangerous.
Gary,
I call this the racism in food.
It is.
Bad white is superior.
Right.
To all the colors of the world.
We have 4 minutes left. I would like for you to have this opportunity, uninterrupted, to explore all the options that you feel are important for India and others in the world since we share common issues.
I think one of the options that's most important is to remember Gandhi. It's 100 years of his writing, this little book which is the Manifesto of Freedom. It's called Hind Swaraj. And that's where he articulated how an electoral democracy will always be shallow and in the long run will always only work for big money and big power. So you need much more direct democracy. But in a period where fascism of all levels, whether it's fascism imposing mandatory vaccines, fascism forcing you to eat GM food without labeling and testing, fascism that takes farmers' right to save seed away from them, all those varieties of new emergent fascisms can only be dealt with in the way Gandhi talked. He said, as long as the illusion exists and the superstition exists that unjust laws are meant to be obeyed, so long will slavery, injustice, and domination exist. That's what Martin Luther King learned from Gandhi. And that's why he led the civil liberties movement in the United States. We just had a law in a southern state of India saying it would be illegal for anyone, people like me, to teach farmers organic. You had to have a biotech degree or a degree in chemical farming to be able to offer a service to farmer, including voluntary service. We declared a civil disobedience. The government was forced to withdraw that act. Good luck for your rally tomorrow, Gary. I hope this mandatory vaccination will be withdrawn.
I thank you. I will send you a copy of it today because it's the same science that you will or your sister will have to look at to challenge it there, and all the best.
We'll appreciate that.
All the best to all of the work that you're doing. We appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us today. My guest today in our conversations with Remarkable Minds, Dr. Vandana Shiva.